we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Center for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore. There's something especially fun about reading a book that's set in your world. Maybe I feel this particularly as an Aussie who grew up on classic English fiction, you know, Enid Blyton and Roald Dahl and Agatha Christie. So when I read something set in Australia, in Sydney even, my hometown, there's a whole different layer of recognition. Claire Zorne is a local girl. She was born in Penrith and grew up in the Blue Mountains just west of Sydney. And she writes young adult novels. I'm not going to list all the awards they've won because it would take too long, but two out of three of her books so far have won Book of the Year from the Children's Book Council of Australia. These are my go-to books for teens and preteens. They are great. The Sky So Heavy takes you through what it would be like to wake up one morning post-nuclear apocalypse if you're a teenager in the Blue Mountains. The Protected deals with bullying and with loss. The main character, Hannah, her sister has been killed. And Claire's most recent book, One Would Think the Deep, which is set south of Sydney in Wollongong, it has surfing and grief and issues of race and how guys think about and treat girls and a bunch of other things going on. I wanted to get Claire into the studio for Mental Health Week to ask her a bit about her experience coping with mental illness. But we talked about a lot of the fun stuff first, like, did she always want to be a writer? To which the answer was a very forceful no.
So when I was in school, like primary school, I wanted to be an artist. And I wanted to be like an Olympic show jumper. And then I wanted to be an actress for a bit. And then I wanted to be a vet.
You went the whole range.
Yeah, I went the whole range. But I always wrote a lot of stories. And then high school, it was mainly art focus for me. And I briefly toyed with going to into design, but then I ended up going to art school straight after high school. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until several years later that I started to think that perhaps I could make a go of it writing. Yeah.
How did that happen?
That's a good question. I suppose I always had these preconceived ideas of the sort of person a writer was. And I just didn't have, I didn't have a whole lot of confidence in my ability to write from high school age, because I used to get quite stressed during exams and all that kind of thing. So I kind of left it alone for a long time. But when I was at art school, I ended up doing video art, which is pretty mental. But it's that stuff that when you walk into an art museum and you go into a darkened room and there's a weird video playing, that's what I used to do.
Weird was the, installation.
Yeah. That was my thing.
Very cutting edge.
Yeah. So I started to use a lot of text in my videos, and then I started writing short stories for the videos, and then I realised I was more interested in the short stories and the characters than what was going on, in the video. So it kind of went from there. I worked in a shoe shop and I started writing, and I'd have a exercise book hidden under the cash register where I started to jot down ideas.
Like all the great writers.
Yeah.
working in Williams, jobs and then, jotting down their amazing thoughts on the side. Do you have any of those stories from when you were little? Still.
No.
Oh, really?
No, we have none of them.
But posterity, Claire.
Yeah, I know. My spelling and punctuation, but particularly my spelling, was absolutely atrocious right up until, uni. It was distracting for most people, I think.
So people weren't saying to you, Claire, but you must be a writer.
No one.
Okay.
No, except for my Year 4 teacher.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Mrs. Richards, her name was. Oh. And she told my parents that they should give me an exercise book and some pencils and just let me write stories.
Wow. So you always had stories, you always had characters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I do, in primary school, my whole world was I lived in this pretend world. I'd make up characters for myself and I'd imagine, you know, these whole entire worlds. And it wasn't until much later when I started doing interviews and things like this that I kind of connected the dots of what I was doing before, creating narratives essentially.
Because you thought everyone did that?
Yeah, I thought it was normal. Yeah. And then I got to high school and realised not normal.
And what do you mean by, like, you didn't think that, you thought that a writer was someone different to what you are? Like, I feel like you look really cool, you have cool hair.
Oh, thank you.
Cool clothes, and you look like a writer to
thank me. Thank you very much. I've worked very hard on my writer look.
What did you think a writer was meant to be?
I think I thought that they were, you know, a very serious kind of intellectual, well-read sort of person. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I am like that. But I
you
kind
read?
Of, yeah, I do read a lot. But I think I thought that it was someone who, you know, who read the classics and who loved, you know, James Joyce. that sort of thing. Whereas I didn't really read that stuff, you know. I read a lot of other stuff. But I don't know. I just thought it was someone very different from the sort of person I was.
Yeah. So what did you grow up reading? Are there particular writers who have influenced what you make?
Yeah. Look, when I was a teenager, there was not nearly as many books as there are now for young adults. So it was fairly limited when I was a kid. I think I read, you know, The Babysitter's Club throughout primary school and books about horses.
Me too. Saddle Club.
Yeah. Well, that was after my time. Oh. Yeah, I was devastated to have missed out on Saddle Club. Yeah, so I kind of read that stuff when I was in primary school. By the time, you know, I was finishing primary school, my friend had this book that she said, oh, you have to read this. And it was Looking for Ali Brandy by Melina Marchetta, which is now considered, you know, a classic of young adult literature. Because I'd read a lot of Robin Klein. I think I read all of Robin Klein's books. And other than that, there wasn't a lot around. And so I read this book, Looking for Ali Brandy, and half of it I didn't really understand. But I loved it.
Yeah.
And it's probably the book I've read the most, if you go back over my,
yeah, wow,
reading history.
So how did you decide to start writing young adults?
That was kind of a... That was a funny kind of thing. I read Bridget Jones' Diary.
That is not where I thought that was going.
Okay. and I, you know, I still find that book hilarious. A lot of, you know, feminist thinkers aren't very impressed by that, but I still find it hilarious. Uh-huh. And I wanted to write something really in that tone, like... I wanted to set it in high school, and I don't know why I chose high school. I think I was only like 20, 22 at the time. And I read another thing, you know, when I was like 13 and 14 by Gretel Colleen called My Life is a Toilet, which is a hilarious book. And I kind of thought that I wanted to do that sort of thing. So I started writing this 14-year-old girl. As I began writing, I realised that I didn't have a lot of hilarious stories to tell about being 16, and it all turned rather serious pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And the other part of my decision was purely pragmatism. I knew that this was around the time The Book Thief just exploded. Jasper Jones by Craig Sylvie was the same. And I knew that there was an emerging young adult market.
So strategic.
It was a little strategic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also I liked that voice. A lot of the books that I read, particularly when I was at uni, I seemed to be drawn to that kind of teenage voice and that teenage viewpoint. So it kind of worked. Mm. Yeah.
And you write about, I mean, really these teenagers, at least so far, you've written about these teenagers in these quite catastrophic situations or in the wake of quite catastrophic situations. So, you know, Finn in The Sky So Heavy is kind of facing a nuclear apocalypse.
Yeah, that's pretty catastrophic.
Yep, so as catastrophes go, like it's up there. Yeah. Hannah has lost her sister and is facing, you know, sad bullying at school and so on. And then that's in The Protected. Mm. And then in One Would Think The Deep, you have Sam who's just lost his mum really suddenly.
Yeah.
And, you know, has other issues as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that, like, is catastrophe kind of a prerequisite for you? Like,
well,
is that what you're interested in?
My specialty is catastrophizing. That's,
oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. I have a pretty pretty high dose of anxiety, and my specialty is catastrophizing. Mm-hmm. So my mind would generally go down the what if route, whether I want it to or not. So with my books, I tend to use that, you know, what if this happens, then what if this happens. That was particularly with The Sky So Heavy. And I think, I don't know, it's interesting to place a character in a situation where they are really challenged by the kind of the space that they find themselves in. That makes for really rich writing. Mm. I think it's this kind of order lost, order restored kind of thing. Yeah. I don't restore order.
Well, but it's not simple, right?
Straightforward. Yeah. So, you know, pull the character apart and kind of piece them back together. Yeah.
Can you imagine yourself writing something about a kid who, like, maybe just has a kind of normal life, who hasn't had something terrible happen to them?
Yeah, I think so. I'd quite like to write upper primary fiction about girls that are obsessed with horses.
I'd love to read it.
Yeah, so I've got a little plot line in my head already, so maybe I'll pull that one out at some stage. Yeah, I'd like to move away from the intensity of the stuff that I have written about for the last three books. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of worked for you. Like, your books have won all these awards and been nominated for all these awards.
Yeah.
Has that been weird, great?
Very weird.
Yeah?
Yeah. Extraordinarily so. Mainly because with The Protected, you know, that was the first book I actually wrote. It was the second book to be published, but it was the first book that I wrote. And I think maybe there's a thing with first books that they tend to be the ones that are most, they have the biggest slab of you in them. Mm. And that character definitely did for me. And I really drew on a lot of stuff that I experienced in high school and that I saw other people experience. And, I mean, they were the worst years of my life. And, you know, when you're going through this stuff and your whole world is, you know, this high school kind of community, and it just seems so small and so horrible sometimes. Mm. I remember my dad saying to me, "You will use this, like this, you will use this for something. This experience will be used." And I was like, "Whatever, Dad, you know, that does not help at all."
but how right he was.
He was absolutely right. So it's really odd to kind of think that I used all of that stuff, particularly with The Protected, and it just kind of, yeah, it won all these awards, and it's been kind of overwhelming. So, yeah, it feels very strange and quite surreal.
Nice, though?
Very nice. Okay. Awards are very nice.
Okay. Yeah. I'm glad to hear it. I find it really fascinating, actually, in One Would Think the Deep, you know, you're writing as a kind of 30-something woman.
Yeah.
in the voice of a teenage boy.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the themes that runs through that novel is this idea of, you know, how boys talk about and think about girls.
Yeah.
And whether, like, this is kind of set in the 90s.
Yeah.
And the sort of misogyny that comes up through that. And I felt really like I totally believed you, but also I'm not a teenage boy and never have been.
Yeah.
And I kind of wondered how you pull that off and know that you're pulling that off.
I was waiting for this question. I've been thinking about it for days. I think the first thing is that people are people. Yeah. Teenage boys are people.
Oh, they are.
They are people. And teenage boys and teenage girls have the same emotions. It just sometimes gets expressed in different ways. That's, you know, that's the big one for me. I'm not too sure exactly why I'm fascinated by that kind of perspective. I think it's partly because when I was a teenager, for me, being feminine was being weak. So, you know, I did the full grunge thing, the, you know, big black Doc Martin boots, the green hair, the
you can picture that.
Yeah. And I listened to, you know, to a lot of music that was very male-centric, I suppose. You know, I listened to Nine Inch Nails and Tool and I loved Pearl Jam. And, you know, it's all very male-centric. But particularly, you know, some of that music also showed vulnerability and emotion and things that we don't often associate with teenage boys. And I think that probably impacted me a fair bit. In a strange sort of way.
And have teenage boys kind of told you that they believed Sam?
It's really, it's really weird.
Yeah.
You know, being at a writer's festival or a school and, you know, you'll get these year 10 boys come over and just say, oh, I really loved this book and you just really got it. And like, yeah, okay.
Wow, that's amazing.
I'm a 36-year-old woman and somehow I've managed to get in a psyche. That's weird.
Do your characters stay with you after you're done with them? Oh, do you still have
big time.
Finn and Hannah and Sam in your head?
Yeah. Oh, big time. And even like the – often it's the kind of the side characters as well that kind of stay with me. Josh from The Protected is still my favourite character that I've ever come up with. Oh, he's just so funny. And he's so sweet. Yeah, he's so lovable.
You have affection for him, but you made him up.
Yeah, it's like he's a real person. Yeah. It's so weird. Yeah, so he sticks. He sticks particularly. And Sam does. And Minty, Sam's cousin in One Would Think the Deep. And it's funny with The Protected, with Hannah in The Protected, when it, you know, it became a book and then it's been released in the US and I had this very strange thing where I was like, I'm so proud of her. Why? She's not a real person, Claire.
Like she's your kid.
Yeah, it's very, very, very much like that. They are like your children, very much so.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. One of the features that pops up over and over when you talk to creative people, read the biographies of writers and artists, is that they seem to experience mental illness at higher rates than average. In the movies, this can sometimes look kind of glamorous, you know, the highly strung genius nobody understands, but of course, it also just really sucks for them. YA novelist Claire Zorn knows this from a whole lot of personal experience. She explained to me that her struggles with mental health started very young.
Yeah, that started really, really early on. I was probably around the age of 11, I think. And of course, when it starts happening, then you don't know that it's not, the word normal is so, that's a bad word, but you don't realise that it doesn't have to be that way. And you don't realise that the way your mind is working is actually unhealthy. And I found it very, very difficult to tell anyone what was kind of going on, partly because I didn't really know what was going on. Mm. I know now, looking back, that I was actually really depressed, which is horrible for an 11-year-old. But I was always an anxious kid.
And that was triggered by something or just...
No, I think it's just the wonders of genetics and there's something about creative brains.
Yeah, because lots of writers, you know, famously kind of struggled with this.
Yeah.
Does that seem... Do you have any sense of what the connection is there?
You know, for me, the only sense I can make of it is that you've got a busy brain. And perhaps you're interpreting things on a deeper level than they should be interpreted. I'm not too sure. I suppose, you know, as a writer, your job is to find meaning in things. So small things that might seem insignificant, you use them in a novel and you give them meaning that works towards your whole, you know, narrative or your whole vibe. That's not a literary term. So I wonder if I've been doing that with all sorts of things throughout life. And if I used to do that when I was a kid and I used to read a lot into things and get scared of stuff. I don't really know. Like I said before, I've got, you know, I specialise in catastrophe. And I think my brain's just always been like that. You know, if you've got a big imagination, you can imagine all sorts of wonderful things, but you can imagine all sorts of terrible things. And you can imagine them in a way that is so vivid and feels so real. Just like, you know, when I'm writing a character, they seem real to me. I think, yeah, that works both ways. Yeah.
So at some point, did you get help? Did you figure out how to articulate this?
Not for a while, hey. Yeah, I kind of carried on through, you know, I remember it kicking off in about year six, and it carried on for a while. And, you know, I think it was year eight, I was in year eight, that I eventually, you know, things kind of capitulated for me in high school the way that they often do in year eight for kids. It's a really tough time. And I, you know, I went to see the school counsellor and they were great. And that was the first time I'd really talked to anyone about the depth of what I was going through. Yeah.
Can you explain it all, like what you were going through? What kinds of things you're having to deal with?
I suppose it's just being very self-conscious. Mm-hmm. Being overly self-conscious, and this feeling of not fitting in, which, you know, now I quite like not fitting in. I like being different. But, you know, when you're a kid, that is the last thing you want to be. I just felt different to the other kids. And I lived in an imaginary world. And when you go from that to the, you know, the intensity of high school and the ruthlessness of particularly teenage girls and the kind of emotional manipulation that goes on. I think poor little me was just completely blindsided by the whole thing. Yeah.
So did that get better? Did you figure out how to cope with it?
Oh, no, that didn't, no.
Well, that's the feel-good story we're going for.
And we'll leave it there. No, when I say no, it got better, but it was university that it got better.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was a while.
It fixed itself.
I just hadn't found my people, yeah, you know. Okay. I think finding your people, it makes a big difference. I simply didn't find my people in high school. I think, you know, I had two or three close friends. I had one very close friend, and often it was just us, you know, and if she was away, oh man, I was stuffed. Like I had to go to the library. I just didn't find my people to university. And I think when you spend all this time thinking that there's something wrong with you, and you think there's all these bad things about yourself, and then you meet people that are like, there's nothing wrong with you, and those things that you think are bad about yourself are actually really good. Yeah, so it was finding my people.
You can feel okay about who you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's part of, you know, I think for every teenager, it's about being accepted for who you are and for what you are. And that's incredibly difficult when you're in high school, I think.
So do you have kind of advice or encouragement for teenagers who do feel like that? Like what, they just need to wait till uni and find their people?
No,
a long way to wait.
You know, I would, my advice would be to do a lot of stuff outside of high school. So, I mean, I talk about feeling quite alone and all that kind of thing, but I had a horse. And so every weekend I'd, you know, be horse riding, and I had a really good friend that I'd ride with. And that made a huge, I think that was how I kind of coped. So I think if you can do extracurricular activities with other people that enjoy the things you like doing, like art, you know, art classes or drama classes or sport or whatever, I think that's a really good thing to do, because you can broaden your horizons as far as the peers that you are exposed to. Yeah.
Now, somewhere in the middle of all this, you went from being an atheist to being a Christian. How did that happen, and
okay,
what difference did that make?
Yeah. So I was brought up Catholic. Yeah, and I was really into Catholicism as a child. Uh-huh. I was really into my first Holy Communion, and I was really into confirmation, and I just kind of, I loved it. I was quite a pious child. but I had no real understanding of the meaning of what Christ did and who he actually was and why he was. I believed in God very, very much, and I understood that God loved me. But when things start to go wrong, or you start to feel very isolated in your life, or things are really hard emotionally, you kind of feel, you know, for me, I was like, I thought God loved me. Isn't he supposed to look after me? And that was, you know, that was it, really. It kind of fell apart. I don't know if I was ever actually an atheist. I was trying very, very hard to be one. So I think by the time I left high school and, university, I didn't really know what I believed. I thought there was maybe a God, but I didn't like him very much.
So what changed?
People, yeah. I made friends at university that, you know, I found my people, and I didn't know that they were Christians at first. And I rang up one of my friends one night, and this was before the days of texting and mobile phones. I rang him at home and he wasn't there. And his mum was like, oh, he's at Bible study. And I was like, what?
Surprise.
Yeah. I was just like, that is mental. But, you know, I had these quite deep friendships with people, and I had a lot of conversations with this one friend in particular who I used to just grill about stuff. He was really great. He was really patient, and he didn't always have the answers, but he was a good one. So, yeah, eventually I just decided to go to church just to see. I just wanted to see, you know. Mm-hmm.
And what did you find there?
Well, I still remember very, very vividly going into, you know, the local Anglican church where my friends went. I didn't tell them that I was coming. They'd invited me a whole heap of times, and every time I'd be like, no way, I've been there. You know, I know all about this God person and I'm not really keen on him. And I made this decision. I don't know why I made it, but I just thought, I'll go. And I walked into the church, and I had this very strange feeling that I was, I wasn't sure if I was going to meet the same God, if that makes sense. Yeah, but I got in there and Psalm 23 was being preached, which is, you know, my mind's going to go blank because I'm recording.
The Lord is my shepherd.
The Lord is my shepherd, you know, though I walk through the valley of death, you know, in darkness, all that kind of stuff. He's there, which is, you know, yeah, that's, you know, that's a pretty famous one, that one. And that was being preached on, and I kind of had this feeling like I'd come home, which, oh, I'm going to tear up a little bit. And I just sat there and cried. I cried throughout the whole thing. I cried through the prayers. I just lost it completely. Yeah. Wow. And I was pretty much from that point on, I was there, I was in.
Is it that you had kind of got an answer to your suffering question?
A little bit, yeah. And I suppose this idea that God isn't going to fix things for you necessarily. I mean, he can. And a lot of times, you know, he does for people. But he might not fix it for you, but he will be next to you as you are going through it. That was huge for me. That was like, I haven't been left alone. I haven't been abandoned. He's still here. And he's still here even though I was like, oh, I'm an atheist and no, I don't like you. I don't believe in you, blah, blah, blah.
So, yeah, you didn't become a Christian and suddenly all your problems went away.
No.
In terms of your depression and anxiety and dealing with those kinds of things, that's an ongoing thing?
That's an ongoing thing. You know, I was very well for a long time. You know, I flourished at university. I met my husband. I got married. I was madly in love. I was, you know, living in a house which was falling apart, but, you know, I painted the walls and had a puppy.
Romantic.
And it was great. Yeah. Had no money, but who cares? Life was really good for a while. It wasn't until I had my first baby that, yeah, I had horrible postnatal depression. And then it was very much, okay, God, what's your plan here? Because I've got nothing.
This has been a recurring thing for you, and it's not kind of fixed.
No.
You can't kind of tick this box and I've, be like, I'm you know, done with that.
I think, yeah, I hope I'm done with it. I don't know how realistic that is. You know, I've definitely had long periods of stability, and medication has been a really important part of that for me. So, you know, you hope that when you get the right formula that you've got, you know, that it will keep things fairly under control for a while. Yeah, but it's not all fixed, no.
How do you manage then kind of now thinking about, you know, day to day and month to month and year to year, making, like, keeping track of your own mental health?
Yeah, so I, you know, everything was going amazingly well. There was the books, there was the awards, the whole palaver. And in 2016, I'm not too sure what happened, but it doesn't really make any sense to me still. But I had a huge, I suppose what you'd call a breakdown, which is such a dramatic word, but it was pretty dramatic, so let's go with that. Yeah, I became very unwell very quickly, and that lasted for 2 years till, you know, June, July this year. So I'm doing really well now, and I've definitely had a few good months under my belt, and things look like they are going to be fairly stable. Yeah.
But you have to kind of keep track of certain things? Or
I keep track of it. Yeah, like, you know, yeah, I'm much better now at managing what I will and won't do. I think when you're starting out as a writer, you want to say yes to everything because, you know, you want to do whatever will help your career, I suppose, and you don't want to turn things down, and so you say yes to everything. And that's taxing after a while. So I really overloaded myself. Now I'm much better at saying no to things and at putting limits on things. So, you know, I've just started doing high school visits again, which is really fun, but I won't do as many sessions as I would agree to do. I'm not doing as many of them as I was before. I'm spacing them out better.
And as someone who, you know, is a writer, people read your books. And especially, you know, teenagers who, a lot of them are struggling with this kind of mental health stuff. Do you feel like it's important for you to be open about your own
experience
with this?
So I think that is the most important thing I can do from now on. If there's nothing else that happened, if there's no more books, you know, no more festivals, nothing, I think the most important thing I can do is be open, particularly to teenagers, about my experiences. Because, you know, if I'd been in year nine or whatever and I'd heard someone say that they'd experienced the kind of things that I was experiencing, that would have been tremendously powerful for me. So I want to be able to provide that. You know, when I've been in really, really bad situations, I'm always drawn to other people's stories because that's where you find, like, that's where you can find a good slab of hope. When you think, you know, this person went through this and they survived and now they're doing good, like now they're doing well. So therefore I can go through this and I can survive. That was super important to me when I was unwell.
So are there particular ways that your faith as a Christian person kind of governs how you deal with this mental health stuff?
It's the realization, I think, or the knowledge that God is walking with me through it, which that sounds kind of strange, but, you know, there's this story of Jesus in the boat with some of his disciples, and they're out on this lake and they've been fishing and stuff. I'm not going to be able to quote you a chapter or anything, but let's go with this.
You're a storyteller.
There's fishing, there's a boat, you know, they're on a lake and there's a storm and Jesus is asleep and his disciples are freaking out and, you know, they wake him up and they're like, why aren't you stopping the storm, you know, and he kind of tells them that he's in control, and he stops it, you know, even though he doesn't have to, but he I suppose where I'm going with that is this idea that he's in the boat with me and that I'm freaking out and there's water coming in, you know, and I'm hoping that I'm going to survive and he's in the boat going, it's okay, you know, I've got this. When you don't understand why things happen or how on earth you're going to get through them or this sort of thing, there's a huge comfort and sense of relief that he's in control. It's not up to me to find answers. It's kind of up to him, and I've got to leave that up to him. Yeah.
You've been listening to Life and Faith with Natasha Moore. If this conversation about mental illness has raised anything for you, do think about calling Lifeline. They're on 13 11 14, or you can chat with someone online at lifeline.org.au. You can walk into pretty much any bookstore in Australia and you'll be able to find Claire Zorn's books, The Sky So Heavy, The Protected, and One Would Think the Deep. You can also listen to a previous conversation we had with Claire on our website, publicchristianity.org. Along with a whole lot of other conversations about life and faith. Next week.
I remember when we lived in the tower block, we were on the 14th floor, and we had 3 fires in a fortnight, and we couldn't get out. So we said to the fire guys, you know, how would we have got out? And he said, oh, well, you know, the ladders reached the 9th floor. And we went, yeah, we're on the 14th. They went, well, helicopters. So a whole gang of us got together in the block, and we went down to the local housing office. And there was, I can still remember it, there was a grill, and we had to speak through the grill. So there's about 20 of us from the block. And a woman behind the grill almost looked at us sideways as if to say, what's the problem? And it was the first time I'd seen, because I'm not from Liverpool, I came when I was 17 to help out. It was the first time I'd seen adults being treated so disrespectfully when there was a major issue of injustice. And for that, for me, that was a real sort of light bulb moment.